You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the first of three podcasts on melanoma hosted by Med Learning Group, titled Updating Best Practices for Management of Advanced Melanoma, Considering Current and Emerging Anti-LAG-3 Combinations in the Veterans Affairs Setting. My name is Cindy Lampner, and I will be the host of today's podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about the immunopathology of melanoma and its implications for treatment. Joining me today is Dr. Adil Daud, Professor of Medicine and Dermatology and Director of the Melanoma Program at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Daud, thank you for joining us.
I'm excited to join you today and looking forward to talking about some of the interesting aspects of melanoma, and especially in the VA setting.
Well, let's start with an overview of the burden of melanoma in the United States. What are recent trends regarding its incidence and prevalence?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. Unlike a lot of other cancers, melanoma incidence has been increasing over the last few decades. And generally speaking, it's gone up year on year. But fortunately, the melanoma deaths have stayed stable or have even gone down. And that is in part because of treatment changes, because of early detection. But it's estimated that 97,000 roughly new cases of melanoma in 2023, according to the CA journal, with about 7,990 deaths in both sexes. And I think overall melanoma remains very curable, very treatable. Most melanomas are diagnosed at early stages. And the survival rate overall is 94%. I think there's a few concerning statistics. That's one is the increase in melanoma incidence in older folks, especially over 50, and especially in women. I think there's been an increase in continuing increase in incidence in women over 50. I think in men, we are seeing we did see an increase in incidence in older men. But that is now stabilized. And in certain populations, we are looking at continued increases. But just to take a step back, about 1 in 38 white people will have melanoma sometime during their lifetimes. And the incidence is 1 in 1,000 amongst Blacks, and 1 in 167 in Hispanics. So there is a difference in incidence in melanoma in these different groups. And also just to remember that melanoma is relatively common in younger people, and it's one of the most common kinds of cancers in people under 30, especially in women. So I think that just gives you an idea of the burden of melanoma in the United States. And also there's an increased prevalence of melanoma in what's known as the Sun Belt, the southern half of the United States, and in the coastal areas, where there's a lot of sun exposure. And I think just goes back to the pathogenesis of melanoma is being driven by UV exposure generally.
Can you talk about the unique challenges faced by veterans in terms of melanoma and how their risk for the disease might be different from that of the general population?
Yeah, I think melanoma is a big problem in veterans. And basically all the factors that are involved in melanoma pathogenesis are all accentuated in the veteran population. Melanoma is more common in males. And of course, we know the veteran population is enriched for that in older folks. And I think service exposure to UV plays a factor, and, skin checks and, which we think are important in diagnosing melanoma early. I think all of those are factors that lead veterans to, generally speaking, have thicker melanomas at diagnosis, more regional and distant metastatic disease, and with the increased incidence of ulceration, which point to the problems in the VA system about just diagnosing these cancers early and recognizing that it's a higher risk population as compared to the general public.
Let's discuss the status of melanoma as a uniquely immunogenic cancer. How does its relationship with immune cells influence cancer cell proliferation, progression, and metastasis?
Yeah, so melanoma has been for many years, the poster child for immune therapy and for and really has been the test bed for a lot of the checkpoint inhibitors that have been in development and continue to be in development over the last few years. And a big reason for that is that UV-induced skin damage just seems to be uniquely immunogenic. And if you take a step back, when melanocytes, you know, which remember they're a cell that is derived from the notochord, from the primitive notochord, resides between the epidermis and the dermis of the skin. And these are very long-lived cells. They kind of like live at that interface. Once they get UV radiation exposure, that creates a specific kind of genetic damage. And that genetic damage often translates into what we call neoantigens, meaning that a type of antigen that is not present in the body generally. And those neoantigens are just uniquely immune sensitive and immune stimulating. And what people think is that the presence of these neoantigens is sensed by dendritic cells, by antigen presenting cells that are present at a very high level in skin. And once these dendritic cells sense the presence of neoantigens, or what are known as damage related pathogen associated molecular patterns, or damage associated molecular pattern, DAMPs or PAMPs, these trigger antigen presenting cells, which then sense the presence of these neoantigens. And then once a dendritic cell is stimulated, it'll mature, go to the local lymph node. There it lies in wait for T cells. And then when it finds the right T cell that matches the antigen that it sensed, those T cells are stimulated. And then in the right circumstance, the T cell will then go back to the site of the abnormal cell and try to eliminate it, try to kill it. And that triggers off this whole cascade where either T cells are able to get rid of the cell, eliminate it completely, or in some cases, not completely eliminate it, but eliminate a certain portion of them. And the remaining tumor cells are able to kind of reach a certain equilibrium with the immune system. And given the right circumstances, maybe antigen loss, if the immune system lets its guard down just a little bit, those mutated cells can start proliferating. And, and there's this dormancy period, which could be months, could be years. After a certain dormancy period, those mutated cells can start proliferating and eventually spread through the body. And that, we think, is how cancer, both coexists with, but in some cases escapes immune, surveillance.
Can you explain the concept of immune surveillance and how cancer cells evade it?
So the thinking today is that in many of us, most of us have some cancer in our bodies, and it's an ongoing process. Whether it's the food that you eat, it's the oxygen that you breathe in. In the case of melanoma, it's UV exposure, which we think plays a big role. It could be smoke. It could be related to food. We think that there's ongoing, continuing damage to DNA. And in the case of melanoma, which we think is really sensitive to UV exposure, we think that those UV rays basically cause DNA damage. That DNA damage is then translated into aberrant proteins that don't really look like your normal proteins to the immune system. And through a still somewhat mysterious process, those aberrant proteins are picked up by cells called dendritic cells or antigen-presenting cells. And then these cells are always sniffing around for the presence of abnormal proteins. They sense the presence of these abnormal proteins. And then essentially undergo maturation and then travel to the local lymph node. At the lymph node, they wait for a prolonged period for the right T cell to come along. And once that right naive T cell comes along, the dendritic cells basically stimulate them, or, you know, with the right molecules. And then T cells then go back to the source of the problem, which, you know, and then they'll locate the cancer and try to kill it. And cancers don't just, you know, lay back and get killed in some cases. They basically evade immune surveillance. And the way they do that is either they lose the antigen in some cases, or in some other cases, they produce compounds and substances that turn off T cells. And these are called immune checkpoints. And you know, the immune checkpoint that's been explored a lot is something called PD-1 or PD-L1. And by pressing on these brakes, they basically turn off T cells and keep T cells in check. And that's how they're able to grow, despite the fact that we have a functional immune system.
What implications does the unique immunogenicity of melanoma have for therapy?
I think the biggest implication is that melanoma is uniquely sensitive to immune therapy. And, you know, we'll talk later about clinical trials that have compared targeted therapy for melanoma to immunotherapy. And basically, immunotherapy is not only very effective in melanoma, but the duration of response is prolonged. So if you have a choice between immunotherapy and targeted therapy in melanoma, in many cases, it makes sense to do immunotherapy, just because if you have a response to immunotherapy, oftentimes you're talking years or forever for the response. While for targeted therapy, you're talking months up to a year for response. So for a given person, the value of a response to immunotherapy is much greater than to targeted therapy. So I think in many cases, it is uniquely sensitive, and people have speculated about why that is. It could be that in the skin, we just have a lot of immune sensing going on. And skin cancers also, because they're often set off by UV radiation, have a lot of mutations, and those mutations produce neoantigens, and those neoantigens set off the immune system in a very particular and very high amplitude kind of way.
Can you give us a rundown of the co-inhibitory and co-stimulatory receptors that are targeted by both current and emerging therapies in melanoma?
There's a long list of checkpoints, and I should add that it's not just co-stimulation, but it's also co-inhibition. That's an important role. So when a T cell makes contact with a tumor, the biggest stimulation comes through the T cell receptor, which basically binds to MHC class 1 molecule on the presence of the tumor, which is, you know, expressing the tumor antigen. So that's what people call stimulus number 1. And usually you need stimulus number 2 and 3. Stimulus number 2 comes from co-stimulation through CD28, and that is the most important gas pedal, so to speak, on a T cell. Now, CD28 is antagonized by a protein called CTLA-4. That was the protein that was discovered by Jim Allison in the 1990s. And that basically set off the whole immunotherapy field. And so CTLA-4 basically competes for CD28. But in addition to CTLA-4, a big gas pedal is PD-1, which binds to PD-L1. We know that's the subject of antibodies like pembrolizumab and nivolumab. But in addition to PD-1, recently there's been a lot of research done on LAG-3, which basically is similar to CD4 and is a sensor for the presence of a molecule called MHC class 2. Now, we think LAG-3 binds to MHC class 2, but it also binds to many other antigens, like, for example, LSEC, and some carbohydrate antigens or lectins. In addition to LAG-3, there's a protein called TIM-3, which is under active investigation right now, as well as TIGIT and BTLA. So these are co-inhibitory receptors. These are brakes on the T cell, but then there's also gas pedals. And the gas pedal that has the most track record is something called 4-1BB, which has been explored now for 10 years. The problem with 4-1BB agonists, so basically antibodies that stimulate 4-1BB, has been that even though they can be associated with some tumor responses in phase one trials, you do see a lot of liver function test abnormalities. But then there's also other co-stimulatory receptors like GITR, OX40, and something called ICOS, which bind to their own ligand. So if you think of T cells, they have gas pedals, they have brakes, and they also have steering mechanisms, which we won't talk about today. But essentially, the antibodies that are directed to the gas pedals will be inhibitory, and the antibodies that are directed to the gas pedals will be stimulatory. So that you're basically trying to increase the activity of T cells in both cases.
What is the immunopathological rationale for using combined immunotherapies in patients with melanoma?
If you look at the response rate to single agent PD-1, it's about 30 to 40%. And so the majority of patients won't have a response, or if they do have a response, eventually they'll progress. And so the idea is that we have immune recognition in about 2/3 or 70% of melanoma patients. Of the 70% who are PD-L1 positive, only about half of them will respond to single agent checkpoints. So the idea of combining checkpoints is that you might get more activity in a given patient with melanoma, and you might take up that ceiling of response from 30 to 40% to like maybe 50 to 60%, or in some cases even higher, if you combine the right checkpoints.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dowd. This has been really informative. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you're able to turn into the other podcasts in this series. There are a total of 3, as well as many other types of CME programs that MedLearning Group offers. In the next podcast, we'll dive deeper into treatment strategies for advanced melanoma and discuss the clinical data on anti-LAG-3 antibodies. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACC-ME Essentials. I'd like to give a special thank you to Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity. Have a great day.